Louise McSharry on 2FM.
Everybody loves a cookbook. Even if you're not a big cook, it's so nice to sit and look at the recipes and think about what it might be like if you actually made them. The bonus now is that if you're someone who probably isn't going to cook the recipes, a lot of cookbooks now include a kind of memoir piece. So we thought, who better than to give us some recommendations than columnist and author of her own culinary memoir, Recipes for a Nervous Breakdown, Sophie White. Hello, Sophie.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me to talk about this particular topic, because I am so bad into culinary memoirs.
Well, I wasn't even really aware of culinary memoirs until I read your book, Recipes for a Nervous Breakdown. So maybe just explain to people who don't know, maybe who haven't encountered them, what they actually are.
So a culinary memoir is, sometimes they come like a bit like cookbook with pictures, recipes, and then like some kind of like ramble chat. I'm describing mine specifically there. Sometimes it is much more of a kind of, memoir, traditional memoir, maybe just dotted with recipes. And sometimes it's more like a memoir with just a kind of, it's seen through the sort of perspective of food. Like Nigel Slater's Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger, is a really good example of that one, because there is no recipes as such in here, except he will kind of chattily sometimes say, if you douse anchovies in olive oil, it's going to be good. Sorry, is it too early in the morning for anchovies?
Never.
It never is for me.
Never.
But what Nigel Slater does is he leads like each vignette with a kind of, you know, food item like bubblegum, porridge. I love one that he has called, so he has mince pies one, and then he has following vignette mince pies two. And the first vignette of mince pie is basically discussing how his mum needs to go to the shop and get the fruit mince. And they he has this beautiful passage where they prepare their pastry together. And the thing with the food memoir, I think, is that it's such a universal obsession. Like, we adore eating and we love talking about food. Mm. So it stands to reason that this is like just a really beautiful, tactile, sensual way of exploring a life through their plates. Mm. It's literally like moments, you know, on the lips. Like, yeah. It's really a really strong way, I think, of like bringing people into a moment is to describe how they're experiencing their food. So mince pies too, I think, is just the most relatable quote ever. It goes, "But mommy, you promised." "Darling, I'm sorry. I forgot to get it when I went to the shops. You're hopeless. I hope you die." "I run up the stairs to my room, slam the door and lie face down on the bed. I knew she'd forget. I just knew it." And that's, so I love,
like,
Nigel.
That really explains a lot about Nigel Slater.
Doesn't it? And a lot about me, because I fully relate. So, so there's kind of, it's broad. And the thing is that kind of sometimes bothers me is that the genre of like food memoir has sometimes been seen as kind of slightly lesser or a bit like not writing. Mm-hmm. Because I suppose a lot of the authors might be primarily chefs. And I just think that's just so irritating and patronizing, because some of the best writing like sits in this genre. Like, another one that I've kind of pulled out to talk about is actually Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential.
Oh, I haven't read this, and I have heard so many glowing reports about it.
Yeah.
People just adored him.
I know. Like, when he passed away, I really felt that the devastation was quite palpable. Mm. Like, and he straddled a lot of different kind of worlds, you know. He was obviously a huge television personality. When he started out, you know, in sort of 80s in New York, he was like, by his own kind of summation, like a pirate punk chef bad boy. And he kind of like looked like he was in the Ramones. And his book Kitchen Confidential is basically a kind of a really like ramshackle travel through that world. Mm-hmm. That kind of like, oh, like slinging pots of oil and just excess and debauchery. It's basically like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas if it had been written by Doreena Allen. So he actually initially he had actually tried to write novels and things in the 90s while he was still, you know, on the line in one of the biggest New York chains, Les Halles. I say chains, there was about three of them. Yeah. And he was like, you know, executive chef and writing kind of like funny, hooky sort of crime novels. And then he basically penned a New Yorker essay in the late 90s that was called Don't Eat Before Reading This. And it was all actually about the kind of underworld of restaurants and how, like, if you order like fish at brunch, for example, that's been sitting there a few days and the chef is trying to get it out the door before he has to get it into the bin. Because I suppose traditionally, especially at that time, deliveries and things like that would have meant the fish might have come in on the Friday and he's tried to sell it Friday night. He's tried to sell it Saturday night. And then by brunch, he's like slipping it on as a special. So, you know, it's just really funny. And also, like, he is a great one for just absolutely like dispelling any kind of snobbery when it comes to food, eating, cooking. You know what I mean? Like, he just has no time for it. And you could always tell that in his like many fabulous TV shows.
Yes. I love that. I hate the hoity-toityness around food. It's so ridiculous, like, to kind of decide that one pleasure is good and another pleasure is bad, or even that you should feel guilty about any pleasure is so ludicrous to me.
Or that there is like definitely one single right way.
Well,
I mean, except that when it comes to scrambled eggs, which I think we've discussed, there is only one way with scrambled eggs.
I agree. There is only one way, and milk should never be involved. But actually, yeah. I think that's interesting because I know that you were just away writing for a week on an island off the coast of Ireland.
I know, I'm very windswept and artistic over here.
But I thought it was really interesting because I saw you posting on your Instagram that like, you love to cook, and I know you plan meals meticulously and you put so much thought into them, and like, you are always asking other people, what are you planning for your meals? You just love to think about it. But when you were there, you only ate like freeze-dried bags that you add water to, like an astronaut or something.
Yeah, it was like I was on the moon.
And you enjoyed it?
I had like this weird, like, I developed a weird love of maltodextrin, I believe is the ingredient. Now, this is just going to, I'm just going to sound like horrific. Like, I have led a charmed life of very little add boiling water to food. Like, I started chefing in my early 20s. And so, like, I suppose when other people were probably adding a lot of boiling water to things, like, I just kind of wasn't as much. And I just, I never really just gone down that path. So I really leaned into it when I was on Inishman. There was like, you know, it was like, there was food around actually, and lovely food being served on the island in many beautiful restaurants. But I, I was just exploring all of the kind of flat pack pasta options in the shop.
Did you have a favourite?
Yes, I did. I enjoyed a, what was it called? Oh, yeah, it's called Mugshot. and it was like, sort of like, pasta, but it seemed bizarre, like, because the sachet was so tiny, it was like the size of a cassette tape. So how could it contain a full portion of pasta in there? Well, oh my god, through the magic of food science.
Well, I was raised on a lot of that kind of food, and I still absolutely love it, and I think that's the point, is that, like, you know, one pleasure is not greater than another, and whether it's necessity or choice, you know, people should eat what they want and there shouldn't be a judgment around that.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that, like, you know, Nigel Slater, for example, would have been really brilliant about this a lot earlier than other people, using tinned fruit, vegetables, everything, a lot of, like, using frozen, not being snobby about the freezer. And I think that's, like, obviously absolutely the way it should be. I agree, but I always noticed that there was like a funny hangover maybe from the 70s where a lot of meals were coming out of the freezer and maybe they weren't, like, you know, nutrient packed. But, you know, I've noticed a lot of a discussion about it lately because obviously, like, a healthy quote unquote diet, you know, is expensive. And so it's great to see like chefs and food writers talking about the freezer, the tinned, and how it is in no way lesser and every bit is delicious. Can I talk about another delicious food memory real quick? I know that, I mean, how long is a piece of string?
Keep
I could
going.
Talk about this forever. But I do think this is a really beautiful book, and it's like, I see every one of these comes at food from such different places and angles. And this is by an American writer called Jessica B. Harris. She is Dr. Jessica B. Harris. She was a journalist before she was a food writer, and she has written over a dozen books on African and African American cooking. And so her cookbooks are like just sumptuous, like divine, you know, oh, like loads about kind of okra and grits and just delicious, hearty food. And they actually even inspired a Netflix series that was based on one of her most famous cookbooks. It's called High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. And it's on Netflix right now. And it's hosted by a guy called Stephen Satterfield, who is a food writer and sommelier himself. Mm. And she features in it. And like, she's unmissable because she's an amazing character. She's an amazing presence. The whole just world that they're exploring is just so colourful. It's vibrant. It's rich. Mm. And I really recommend her culinary memoir. Although, like, is it a culinary memoir? You know, it kind of treads a line. And it's called My Soul Looks Back. Mm. And so it's amazing because there is loads of, like, delicious food. Every chapter ends with a recipe. Mm. So, you know, you get her mother's Sunday roast chicken. Some stuff I'm going to struggle to pronounce. Goujonette de sole with ersatz sauce gribiche. It's her favourite after opera meal.
You're doing your best.
If I get in touch by text to school me on that. And then along with all these delicious meals, she's like charting her amazing life in the 70s in New York. She was like friends with Maya Angelou. She went everywhere and she knew everyone. Maya Angelou.
I'm experiencing a physical yearn to read this book.
I know. Oh my God. It just sounds like her apartment in the 70s was just this amazing, like, New York salon. She'd like, Toni Morrison was kicking around chatting to James Baldwin.
I love how, like, I really want to know who decided that having people around, if they were intellectuals, was called a salon rather than a party.
I know. Or like, do you know when, like, you know, you're having an interview, but if it's quite literary, you're not having an interview, you're actually just in conversation. It's so classy. It really elevates things. But I love the story of her meeting Nina Simone, which I have to tell you. Yes. So she walks into a party and she hears Nina Simone roaring, "Who's the bitch in the red dress?" And Jessica Biel Harris is quite young. And then she looked down and she realized, "I'm wearing a red dress. I'm the bitch in the red dress." Nina Simone is talking about me. But anyway, I mean, it's food and it's life and it's love. 70s. It's the 70s. It's glamour.
Yes.
And then, like, I have to just tell you one final one because it's Irish. Yes. And it is, I think, a little bit overlooked. Certainly, I think, by some. And, like, if you weren't, like, totally bet into food memoirs, you may not know about Theodora Fitzgibbon. Mm. She was, like, she was everything. She basically had, like, actually, Maeve Binchy herself described her as a woman who had many lives. She was, in fact, many people all rolled into one. It's so true. Like, Theodora Fitzgibbon was basically born in London. She travelled extensively with her father. She was, like, in India, Europe, the Middle East. This is all in the 1920s, 1930s. Yeah. It's said that she received cooking lessons from the former Queen Natalie of Serbia at a finishing school in Paris, as you
of
do.
Course.
Like, of course. And she also wrote for the Irish Times for years and years and years. She was their food writer. She produced more than 30 cookbooks.
Wow.
She had a whole series that was like A Taste of Rome, A Taste of Ireland, A Taste of Ireland sold 250,000 copies in 1968. Isn't that incredible? So her memoir is A Taste of Love.
Yeah.
And it charts her life literally from everywhere. Like, she lived in London in the Blitz. Mm-hmm. She lived in Paris in the 30s and hung around with Cocteau, Dali, Picasso. In London, she was friends with Francis Bacon, Lucian Freud.
Oh.
She was friends with Dylan Thomas.
She was an it girl.
Yes, she was a total it girl. And she was an it girl who, like, wore her appetites, like, you know, right out there. She was consumed with food. All of her memoir, which I think was not written with an idea of being a food memoir or a culinary tour, it is, like, consumed with cobbling together meals in wartime. She talks about, like, the food they made in times of poverty, in exotic places. She kind of was one of those kind of it girls with, I guess, like, not a whole lot of cash in her pocket, you know? And that's so, like, you love that about her.
Yeah.
I love this bit where she's gone and moved to Bermuda, like, just like as you do. And she immediately starts making friends, you know, with anyone and everyone around. And she talks about, Sorry.
No.
Get this quote. She talks about how the garden was at the end. She talks about how the sea was at the end of the garden. Mm-hmm. And she'd been told that she had to kind of capture a barracuda. So she writes, "I used to scan the water very carefully before diving off from the terrace steps. One of the most superb fish to eat was young barracuda, another man-eater. Steaks mm-hmm. cut from it, brushed with oil and herbs and grilled over wood, tasted like the finest kind of veal." Like, I just love Theodora's appetite.
I want to eat.
Yeah.
I was about to say, I want to read all those books, but my brain said eat, which I think is actually very appropriate.
Yes, that's it. You devour them.
Oh, so
I want to tell you about them all, but I know that we've come to the end of the line.
We never have time. But name just a few quick mentions.
Quick mentions. Like, there's two really recent ones just out. One is by Grace Dent, yes. who is English restaurant critic. Great woman, great writer. She is so funny. And her book, Hungry, is like a very poignant account of her life and her relationship with her father and how it was shaped with food. And
she's really good on pillaring all the snobbishness as well, because of course she writes a lot about being working class and growing up working class, and that the
grew up in the north
that had with food. Yeah, great.
North of England, by the way, sorry in case that was not clear. I love Marion Keyes's book, yes. Saved by Cake. That people may not be on your radar because it was like a few years ago, but Marion wrote this book after she had like come through this like really severe bout of depression, and she'd found little could really help her through those days except this kind of solace she had in baking. And she ended up producing this beautiful cake. Oh my God, what are we like? This beautiful book called Saved by Cake. And actually, I didn't know this at the time, but all of her Irish royalties went to St. Vincent de Paul, which, you know, obviously she's such a beautiful person. Oh. And then she's just like privately just so fantastic as well.
What a queen.
But she wrote in that, "I liked feeding people and I liked making things look beautiful. And at times I needed something really complicated to focus on because I couldn't bear being in my own head." Which is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And then there's one that is brand new out by a writer called Erin French. Uh-huh. And it is called Finding Freedom in the Lost Kitchen. And I think it is like, if you liked Wild, for example, or you liked An Education by Tara Westover, this you will really like, because it's about her kind of, you know, weathering a lot of like a series of rock bottoms. She'd grown up like in quite difficult circumstances in rural Maine and I was about to say Pennsylvania. I'm like, American geography. But yeah, and she has struggled with substance abuse. She has struggled to regain custody of her child. Mm. And she also has this incredible, beautiful, really highly regarded restaurant that she's created in Maine called The Lost Kitchen.
Yeah.
And this is her story of, I suppose, finding freedom there.
Well, I have to buy all of them.
I know.
I mean, truly, you have sold them so well. Thank you so much, Sophie White. And of course, Sophie, can people get your, I know at one stage it was quite hard to get your recipes for Nervous Breakdown, your food memoir. Is that still the case?
I actually think that it is back out and about. More and more people are telling me that they're picking it up. So it was out in 2016. But if you look on Amazon, unfortunately, I think might be
best place.
One of the places.
Yeah.
Obviously, very much, please try an indie bookshop first if you can.
Recipes for a Nervous Breakdown is, of course, the food memoir of Sophie White, who's in front of me. Thank you so much for bringing us all of those. Louise McSherry on 2FM.